Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, offering Mac computer repairs for screen fixes, liquid damage, backup services, hard drive issues, and other problems. More information at techserve.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And this is the moment, folks. We have arrived. The planet hangs in the balance as Paris gets down to the fine print. Secretary Kerry?
If 184-plus nations sign on to a durable agreement with review and accountability and transparency here in Paris, you watch the world begin to change. The world begin to change. The world begin to change. The world begin to change.
Secretary of State John Kerry had that high-minded promise for the COP21 delegates on climate change when he spoke this week, just like all of the other leaders who spoke in remarks at the conference. Now the nearly final draft of the COP21 agreement will attempt to make good on those promises in a real document for all the world to see, with provisions like a fund for small nations facing, in some cases, obliteration due to sea level rise. David Biello is an editor at Scientific American covering the COP21 conference in Paris. David, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you. Greetings from Paris.
Yes, indeed. So how is this agreement fundamentally different from the kinds of agreements you've covered in these conferences in the past?
Well, it's different in that this time the countries actually came prepared. You'd think after 23 years, they would always get their homework done on time, but they haven't in the past. This time they have. 186 countries brought their plans to combat climate change, and that has kind of enabled them to try to forge a more ambitious agreement than perhaps some people were thinking.
So suddenly Mr. Science over at Scientific American has to be kind of a diplomat covering the creation of a global treaty here. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. And I actually was just interviewing one of the Chinese negotiators, and it kind of felt like, I don't know, negotiating through the press in the person of me as we were arguing about China's coal use and whether they could peak emissions by 2030.
How much of the details in this agreement will be open to accountability? For instance, the 1.5 degrees or 2 degrees or 3 degree limits?
Well, on the one hand, we know it's not going to be a technically legally binding agreement because, frankly, the U.S. can't have a technically legally binding agreement, as that would trigger certain legal ramifications like ratification by the Senate, which wouldn't happen. That said, they are trying to kind of finesse that issue and make it so that on a kind of five-year review cycle, people would come back and raise ambition and potentially commit to a much more legally binding arrangement.
What is unresolved at this point, and between now and the end of this conference, how will Paris and the organizers of the conference really force things to an end game?
Well, everything is still on the table. I mean, the most important things. What will be the temperature limit we're aiming for? Is it 2 or less than 2? What will be the amount of money available to countries that have suffered loss and damage from climate change, or those who are going to struggle to adapt? Most importantly, will everybody come to agreement on whether these agreements will be revisited in future? I mean, of course they will, but whether that will be put us on a path to a kind of more ambitious climate change pollution-free world or not.
Are there divisions that we see right now? I mean, for years, the developed world versus the developing world was the story. But I'm wondering if there are individual countries, bilateral divisions that are significant now as we're getting down to the details.
It's interesting. Some of those older groupings seem to be fracturing a little bit. A new coalition of sorts has emerged that kind of unifies some of developing countries and some of the biggest polluters, including the U.S. They're calling themselves the High Ambition Coalition, those who are willing to include this 1.5 degree temperature rise target somewhere in this agreement, among other things. That is a much more ambitious target than anybody has really ever talked about before, and it remains to be seen whether the High Ambition Coalition really exists or not. Certainly, China and India are arguing that they need room in the atmosphere to pollute a little bit so that they can drive economic development.
Is this high ambition a symbol, or is it actually a method for aiming really high, and if you miss, you still do better than if you'd been conservative?
I think you're right. I think it's a method, because we're already at 1 degree Celsius of temperature rise. So 1.5 degrees is, in some sense, almost already kind of baked into climate change. But it signals that that people want to do more and will, I guess, continually strive to do so in future. But it remains to be seen whether that high ambition coalition achieves its aims, because certainly there are plenty of countries that that feel that 1.5 degrees is unrealistic, and that 2 degrees might even be too ambitious.
What do you think comes away from this conference? Is the takeaway that it feels like a Magna Carta moment here, or is it more like going to a convention where you're basically looking at a lot of people who agree and are wearing the same T-shirt?
It's kind of a bit of both. If we do get this kind of ambitious, transparent, enforceable deal, that would be a huge step forward on global efforts to combat what is a global problem, global warming. On the other hand, it is also a traveling circus of sorts. A lot of these negotiators have been at this for, 5, 10, 15 years. There's still a lot of room for things to fall apart in the next 48 hours. But I will say that the French, they've been doing diplomacy for a really long time. They've signed a lot of really important treaties over the years, and they've been doing a very impressive job of herding these cats.
Finally, one of the cats that's not being herded this time around are the young people who are delegates and observers. What's their feeling as this conference gets down to the real business here? Are they being listened to? Are they going to pick up this torch in 10 or 15 years?
I think that in part the High Ambition Coalition emerges from some of the pressure that that young people have been putting on their governments over the years, whether it's Keystone XL or calling attention to the plight of, low-lying island states. It's running more smoothly, so we'll see what happens.
David Biello is the editor at Scientific American, covering the COP21 Climate Change Conference from Paris. David, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Also, thanks to the metal band Wellborn Road, whose song Watch the World accompanied Secretary of State John Kerry in our little introduction to that segment. One important consequence of COP21 is to create a culture, a worldwide culture, of measurement of energy use, of carbon emissions, and holding institutions and nations accountable to those emissions and the targets that they come up with in Paris. Individual families and consumers will also eventually have to meet a test, or at the very least be aware of their contributions to carbon emissions. And real measurements are likely to bust some myths about who is the real Bigfoot in the carbon footprint competition. Cindy Eisenhower is an assistant professor of anthropology at the University of Maine and author of Sustainability in the Global City, Myth and Practice. Who thinks they're really good at keeping their emissions down, Professor Eisenhower, and who maybe is a much more egregious emitter than they think?
Well, it's an interesting question, and maybe not one that we would think as highly intuitive, but I think most research points to the idea that folks in the city think that they have smaller footprints, and folks in the country think they have smaller footprints. So it kind of harkens back all the way to Aesop's fable of the country and the city mouse. But in reality, we're finding many studies emerging that would suggest that if we account for all of the things that people buy, that cities oftentimes have higher footprints despite the efficiency gains associated with living in really dense settlements.
And that would relate to the fact that there's a kind of overhead associated with the city that you may not be individually emitting if you go from here to the bodega to get, a very simple meal or something. But because you are living in the city and the infrastructure is there at your disposal, you're a part of the problem in a way.
Yeah, we find that folks who live in the cities, many of them are very concerned about climate change and rather aware, actually. And part of that decision may be to live in the city to, you know, be closer to the bodega, as you say, or to live in an apartment building with a smaller footprint and use more efficient technologies. And that's great. And we should absolutely be doing that. But what we also do know is that folks who live in the city do tend to be a part of a culture that has social norms that script for higher levels of consumption. We find in cities folks who are early adopters, they are more responsive to ideas about fashion or technological obsolescence. So they do tend to replace things such as clothing, furnishings, electronics more frequently. And while we don't often think about the emissions associated with those things, they are quite impactful. Their emissions don't occur within the city.
And for people in rural communities, what sorts of things might they not pay attention to that are really important in determining their footprints?
Yeah, I think, as you say, transportation is a really big issue, and housing size. So many of the houses are detached homes, and they are not as efficient in terms of heating. So the direct energy use and the direct emissions are more impactful in the rural areas, whereas the indirect emissions, or that what we would call embodied energy, is more impactful in the urban emissions scenarios.
A statistic that was mentioned over and over again at COP21 was that 70% of the emissions come from cities. It's really going to be more efficient to focus on cities to reduce than it is to try to retrofit all kinds of far-flung places around the world. What would the strategy be? What kinds of things would have to change to significantly alter that number of 70% of the emissions coming from cities?
Yeah, so I think there are a lot of great strategies, and many cities have been leaders in this area, beginning with focusing on efficiency gains. So improving the transportation infrastructure, designing city planning specifically to reduce the need for transportation. Lots of cities are also starting to work on more local food provision, which is really important, we've come to understand. So those efforts are really important. And I would just argue that, in relation to the, argument about whether city or country living is more sustainable, I think cities are heading in the right direction, and it makes a lot of sense to focus there as long as we don't neglect the impact of consumption.
Cindy Eisenhower is an assistant professor of anthropology at the University of Maine. She's the author of Sustainability in the Global City, Myth and Practice. Cindy, thanks so much.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
This week, Time magazine named German Chancellor Angela Merkel their Person of the Year. She's the fourth German leader to be so named since Time began this year-end ritual. Merkel joins Konrad Adenauer, Willy Brandt, and Adolf Hitler. Angela Merkel is a unique witness to the history that includes those three other leaders. Raised in East Germany, she's gone from child of the Cold War to champion of the European Union. Her lifetime spans a Germany seen as feared and to be controlled, to a Germany the success of which is the only thing that can hold the euro together in light of an imminent crisis and the potential of default for some euro members. Is Merkel the linchpin of stability for 21st century Europe? Ulrike Garrow is founder and director of the European Democracy Lab at the European School of Governance.
I think what we are seeing is basically three crises which came together. There was first the exit of Greece of the Eurozone, and this was peaking in July this year. Then we had the refugee crisis, and now we have a terror crisis. So there's really three things. And Mrs. Merkel is one of these outstanding heads of states. I mean, in The Economist had that piece about the indispensable leader, because there's nobody else out there. So every eyes is turned to Mrs. Merkel for fixing basically the whole European crisis solution. I think that's what it's all about.
Do you think Merkel imagined that she would go from being raised in East Germany, where, I mean, you're really buried alive in East Germany during the Cold War period, to being this global leader who really has to decide on scenarios that were inconceivable during her time in East Germany?
Well, no, I mean, who could? We have so much changing political realities these days, which is breathtaking, you know. I mean, from Brexit again to refugee crisis to terror, who would have thought that 3 months ago about the destiny of the European Union? So, no, all this was unforeseeable. Merkel as a woman coming from former GDR, then making it to chancellor, first woman chancellor in Germany also, in a conservative party. So this is really, really big news. And now she's celebrating her 10 years in power. So I think this is a brilliant career. And it reminds me a little bit like the two former chancellor we had in Germany, first Helmut Schmidt, who just died, who just passed away, and then Helmut Kohl, who also became lately in their chancellor years, basically they turned from party leader to statesman, right? If you remember Helmut
sure.
Schmidt, he did the Pershing thing. I mean, he defended the American missiles against the SS-20 of the former Soviet Union, and he lost his party, but became a statesman about this decision. And then Helmut Kohl, who was a not so much respected chancellor in the first time he had, but then came unification in 89, German unification, and that made him became a statesman. So for Merkel, it's a little bit like this. She was a very, very tough party leader, always had the party, but now she's turning into a German, let alone perhaps even European statesmanship, which is she runs Europe in a way. But on the other hand, she seems to be losing her party, for instance, on that refugee question, because Germans are sort of split now on what can we do on refugees.
10 years for Angela Merkel. Do you think she's having any fun?
I think she must be very stressed. These days aren't easy. I mean, between the refugees and the terror and the intertwinement between the two questions, I think it's really, really dark days. For Europe, we are reducing security. We are having reflections like, I mean, it's a little bit the European 9/11, and we're having similar discussions than the US had with your very sad terror event. So it's hard time to secure an agenda of civil liberties. It's hard time to be welcoming to refugees. We need to think about that war question. What do we do with Syria? There is obviously a problem how to deal with Putin. We haven't been even talking about the Maidan and the Ukraine question, the Crimea annexion. So no, I think Europe is under deep strain. We have an amalgamation of a complex series of crises which came very quickly one after the other. And to be honest, I wouldn't want to be in the skin of Madame Merkel. She probably has the toughest time of her life these days.
Ulrike Garrow is founder and director of the European Democracy Lab at the European School of Governance. Thanks so much.
Welcome.
It's no secret. The United States Secret Service is an agency in crisis.
Perhaps what we should do is lean on the United States military, the FBI, U.S. Marshals, others, to be assigned or detailed to the Secret Service for the next 12 months so that they can make it through the presidential election. We need people who can wield a gun, know what they're doing, and be trusted.
It's House Oversight and Government Reform Chairman Jason Chaffetz, who's a Republican of Utah, calling in the cavalry to help the Secret Service recover from a series of lapses over the last 7 years. Todd Zwillig, Takeaway Washington correspondent. We've got a report now from the Congress and a call for action. Remind us of the lapses of the Secret Service and react to Chaffetz's call for other federal personnel to do the service's job.
Yeah, hi, John. Well, this is a report detailing an agency in deep crisis. It's an ongoing investigation for about the last year, and it's just become final on the Hill. Now, some of these incidents are going to be familiar to you, and there's a lot new in this report, too. It really all starts back in November 2011. Shots fired at the White House from the Ellipse, just south of the White House, by a man with a semi-automatic rifle, and it took days and days for the Secret Service to determine the source of the bullets. In April 2012, the famous misconduct in Cartagena, Colombia, in advance of a presidential trip, Secret Service agents drinking, soliciting prostitution, bringing prostitutes back to their rooms and causing embarrassment for the White House. September 2014, the knife-wielding fence jumper who got over the fence across the North Lawn and into the White House and made it as far as the East Room, but made it much further than Secret Service officials originally told Congress. They had to come back and clean up the story afterward, and then Director Julia Pearson resigned shortly after that incident. And then there was the incident last year, which you'll remember, at the Centers for Disease Control down in Atlanta, when a security contractor with a police record and a gun on him was able to get on an elevator with the president and stand right next to him. John, listen to Secret Service Director Joe Clancy here. He was promoted to the director job after other leaders were fired. He's been testifying on the Hill a lot lately.
And I've heard the comments that were made today, reprehensible, disturbing, embarrassing. I agree with everything that's been said here today, and my workforce does as well. But a hearing like this puts a definitive stamp on our failures.
Leadership failure? A culture of abuse? What's going on here?
Well, the report details an agency that is chronically understaffed, has had its staff cut by hundreds over the last couple of years, both by budget cuts, which Congress bears part of the responsibility for, but also by attrition. Attrition, why? Because of low morale. People don't want to work there anymore. They want to get out. The report says there's a culture of targeting whistleblowers, that it's well known among agents and personnel that if you complain, that your complaints are going to be met possibly with retribution and certainly with the opprobrium of officials there. John, there's a lot new in this report, too, some of it pretty shocking. There's an incident from last September where a man posing as a congressman got past agents and was actually escorted to speak personally with the president backstage at a big awards dinner. There are several incidents of unauthorized and unscreened people getting near the president. There's also new details about that Cartagena trip that I mentioned, the one where Secret Service agents were soliciting prostitution and drinking. Emails detailed in the report among agents and even some officials prior to the trip, sort of celebrating their plans to drink heavily, to bring extra cash for prostitutes, basically revealing, according to the report, a culture within the Secret Service where agents were pretty clear that this was part of their culture and that they weren't going to face retribution for it. There have been other incidents, John, that don't involve agents' personnel, including one very recently, just in the last couple of weeks, of a Secret Service employee working inside the White House who's been arrested for soliciting sex over text message from who he thought was a 14-year-old girl. It was actually a Delaware state trooper, and he's under arrest.
Quickly, Todd Zwillich, can the Marines or U.S. Marshals substitute for the Secret Service? Is that a call Congress can make? Can the president make it himself?
Well, activating the Marines would be difficult. We have constitutional prohibitions on the military operating domestically except in emergencies. The president, I suppose, could activate the FBI or the U.S. Marshals. We're not there yet. But, John, this report details an agency that's in such crisis that if it doesn't change soon, that candidates in 2016 and the president himself are in jeopardy.
And reform will be slow, slower probably than the campaign in 2016. Todd Zwillich, Takeaway Washington correspondent, thanks so much.
You got it, John.
July of 2013, it was estimated that it took an hour to get help in the city of Detroit if you called an ambulance or the police. So the city called a financial ambulance and conceded to the world that it was to be the largest municipal bankruptcy filing in American history. $18 billion in debt. 40% of its streetlights were not functioning. The population of Detroit had fallen from a high of 2 million in 1950 to less than 700,000. Today, a year after putting bankruptcy behind it, the city's finances are in much better shape. Quinn Kleinfelder, senior news editor at WDET, reports it will take some skill to keep the progress going, though.
It's out of bankruptcy, but it has a really razor-thin financial cushion. There's about over $1 billion general fund that they can move around and do things with. City officials say that if they go even $10 million over that billion off of the so-called plan of adjustment, which is the blueprint that they follow coming out of bankruptcy, if they get $10 million off of that, it will mess up the entire picture. The situation could, in essence, collapse.
Who made the haircut? Who got the haircut? And how does the haircut look on some of the people who are having to live with it?
Well, it depends who you talk to. The bond markets are not particularly happy in terms of how things played out. They will say that they got far less in some of the payments than, say, the city retirees whose pensions were lost as well because of this. But they also lost money that people had saved, what they call a clawback, where they say that you got too much interest rates off of the money that was saved. And so all the savings the city had been putting in for these workers over their 20, 30 years that they worked, they lost all of those. Healthcare benefits went away in the bankruptcy. And in fact, they still meet now. They're still trying to pursue some litigation, some of these pensioners. I spoke with one recently named Sheila Baker, who was saying that the situation still at this point both amazes and saddens her.
It went from $73 a month for a single person to $400 a month for me. It makes no sense how they just messing over my money again. You know, because while we were working, 30 years while we were working, we took concessions knowing that at the end we were going to have a decent pension. And then for them to mess with us at the end.
The money that she was talking about is the money for her monthly health care premium, which was, you know, 70-some dollars, and now is about five times that or so.
Do people see the changes? Do they see the investments coming into the city, and they talk about it?
Yeah, it's very noticeable, actually, in terms of particularly the downtown area, and that stretches towards where the university, Wayne State University area, is at. And in those areas, it's simply booming. You see lots of construction everywhere. They're putting in a new light rail line. The company Quicken Loans, their founder Dan Gilbert, brought his headquarters downtown a while back, and he's brought in tons of people. And so there's a sense that stuff is happening, that it's going forward, and that all this investment is there. At the same time, there's concerns when you talk to some of the people in the outerlying communities about whether they're going to be included in the plan. It's gentrification on steroids in many ways. For instance, I spoke with a guy who rides the bus regularly, James Jordan. He looks around the area downtown by where the major bus terminals are, sees what's happening there in terms of construction, and then looks where he lives, which is one of the many neighborhoods in Detroit that still is rife with high unemployment rates, high crime rates, high poverty rates. And he wonders what's going to happen.
There's still a disconnect. Okay, they're opening a Nike shop, but you never hear about a new housing development or a new grocery store being built in the heart of the neighborhood. There's still a feeling like when you come to certain places downtown, we're almost not wanted.
And some of those people, when they talk about that, they will lay that in racial terms as well. When he's talking about we're not wanted, I asked him, off tape then about, you know, who's the we? He said blacks, which, you know, Detroit is a massively majority African-American city and has been for decades. One of the phrases they use is that they see the lightening of downtown, meaning that there's a large segment of white people and a large segment of younger people coming in. At the same time, that's exactly what the city is hoping for. Not necessarily in racial terms, of course, but in terms of people bringing in money, people improving the tax base. And that's the kind of thing they need in order to go forward. And the city has taken lots of different steps to try to make Detroit a place people would want to live in.
Is that a problem for the mayor?
It is a challenge in terms of the overall school situation, which is not great, in terms of how things are going, trying to move some of these properties. Some of the abandoned buildings that are being torn down, the cost of tearing them down has gone far beyond what it used to be prior to bankruptcy. And the mayor will say it's because they have to do some more environmental cleanup and things that they hadn't done prior to these days. But the fact that that has to be done is no question at all to people, that they need to try to either get people into houses that they can refurbish, that are salvageable, and somehow try to create new communities or at least strengthen the ones that are here. And at the same time, get rid of these huge pockets of blight everywhere, which are magnets for crime and poverty, etc. When you talk to the mayor, he will say that they have accomplished quite a lot in terms of getting the transit system better, in terms of garbage pickup, which is a regular thing now and hadn't been in Detroit for a while. But the mayor, Mike Duggan, he'll also say that, you know, there are quite a few challenges that remain.
You know, the biggest thing is we have to get more jobs into this city. We have to cut car insurance. We got to deal with the schools. And those things aren't necessarily city government, but they certainly impact citizens' lives every day, and they're things that we're working very hard at.
They also impact whether or not people would want to look at Detroit as a place to move in. And that's where the city officials say the soft spot could be, is the property tax revenue. If you don't get enough people in and expand that that tax base, then you're not going to necessarily have the money you need to actually move the city forward.
Quinn Kleinfelder, senior news editor at WDET in Detroit. Thanks so much, Quinn.
Thank you, as always, John.
German Chancellor Angela Merkel is Time Magazine's Person of the Year.
Can you top that? Vermont Peely of Vermont, Bernie Sanders is my choice. He is of the people and for the people. He's the most honest person in politics.
This is Dee Dee Tussone from San Francisco. John Stewart. I don't know anyone else who has fearlessly commented with such brilliance on the state of affairs in this country and abroad, and who has had such influence on an entire generation. His commentary got me through many a bad day. I will miss him being in the public eye more than anyone else.
From Willits, California, Edward Snowden. There have been whistleblowers in the past, but in the secret society environment we live in today, he stood up for ethical standards while being part of that secret society and put truth in its place. He has polarized this culture and helped define what our government really is doing behind our backs. And from Anoka, Minnesota, John Hockenberry. Oh, that has to be my parents. That's where they live. 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's our number. And there's much more at thetakeaway.org. Thanks, Mom.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com. Brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide. With personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
We began this hour considering the impact of energy consumption on human life, and we end by remembering how 200 years ago, energy and light came from the oil of whales, and the mad bravery and cruelty of the men who would risk their lives to kill the huge beasts and bring the oil to civilized drawing rooms in London and New York. In 1820, a Nantucket whaling ship called the Essex was on a routine expedition for oil when it was suddenly struck by a whale and destroyed. Only a handful of the crew made it back to civilization, and their stories of fate, fear, and cannibalism would eventually serve as inspiration for Herman Melville's Moby Dick and documented by historian Nathaniel Philbrick in his book In the Heart of the Sea. Philbrick's best-selling book has now been adapted to the big screen after many years. It stars Chris Hemsworth as first mate Owen Chase and is directed by Ron Howard.
A whale, sir. It stove the ship.
What?
We lost Easton and Sanborn.
The pumps are useless, sir.
Prepare to abandon ship.
We can't row our way home. We'd have to strip her of her sails and jimmy-rig something.
I shall gather as much food and water as he can carry.
Philbrick wanted the Essex story to convey just how frightening and exciting it must have been on a whaling ship.
Whaling was tough. It was a factory ship going to places that normal ships didn't, so you were always dealing with the unknown. And you had to kill 40 to 50 whales. And, you know, these are the biggest creatures on the planet. You not only have to kill them, you then have to chop them up into blubber, boil it down. It's a dirty business. But the assumption is you kill the whales. With the Essex disaster, the whale incredibly turns it around on them, and they became the prey. And so it was almost an existential question, you know, what was going on? Had God turned the tables on us?
What was the sense of vulnerability as you tried to imagine it as a writer of being out in the open sea with limited ability to even know where the heck you are?
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing that's, I think, amazing to us in the 21st century. We're so insulated from the world by our technology. You know, we have Google Maps to lead us places. We just have all this. These guys had nothing. They had their navigational instruments, but quickly those became pretty much worthless to them, given the conditions of the whale boats. And they knew their latitude, you know, where they were going.
Right.
But they didn't really know where they were, so to speak. And so the amount of not knowing, the amount of, you know, we just got to keep trying to stay alive is amazing. And, you know, and these guys were not like explorers trying to win glory for themselves and their country, you know, doing a stunt like going across the Antarctic. Right. These guys were fishermen in a voyage that went very bad. And they were just trying to make a living from their standpoint, and here they were.
How do we know about the fate of the Essex? Where does the information come from, and how did people back then understand what happened?
Yeah, well,
to the
you know, quickie journalism is nothing new. Owen Chase, the first mate, came back to Nantucket on June 11th, 1821, you know, within a year of all of this. And by that fall, with the help of a ghostwriter, he had written and published what is one of the great true narratives of the narrative of the Essex. And that got out there. There was, even before that, though, when Captain Pollard was found in his own whale boat, he spoke that night to a group of whaling captains who had gathered on a ship, a gam. And Captain Paddock would record. It's almost, you know, a transcript of what he told them. And it's just amazing. He goes into the detail of the cannibalism, their sufferings. And that Paddock letter went out, was copied, and that was the first word. And so those are the two essential sources when it comes to the story of the Essex.
What was it that led to Chase's survival, and what were the skills that were required once you were alone on the sea?
Well, if I had to have been on a whale boat, I would want to have been on Chase's. He was wired to be a whaleman, what was known as a fishy man, very tough, very driven. And, you know, he was good at getting what he wanted, even if the decisions he was making weren't the right ones at the time. He had the fortitude to keep going. In a survival situation, for example, it looked like they were going to die of dehydration, and they wash up on an island almost 3,000 miles off South America where they're trying to get to. And they find water. They find birds and birds' eggs. So it's okay. But they realize after a few weeks that they're clear-cutting this place. They're going to starve to death eventually. And they find skeletons of people who have been there. And he's the one who says, look, we can't stay here. We have to keep going. And, you know, can you imagine this? You know, they've almost died already. And they're in the middle of nowhere. And he says, let's get in those boats and go to South America, thousands of miles away. And they agree with him, and they do it. And the boats would all get separated. One would be never found again. Pollard's boat would be reduced to just two guys, Pollard and a teenager, and they would be found sucking the bones of their dead shipmates. And Chase and two others would survive, make it basically to the Massafure, an island, you know, right off the coast. And, you know, he just was incredibly, I think, charismatic in his way and driven. And yet, you know, the ordeal stayed with him. Late in life, the headaches that had plagued him ever since his time in the whale boats would come back to him, and he would start hiding food in the attic of his house and eventually be judged insane. And so
this PTSD.
Absolutely.
Right.
It's interesting, though. One of the sources that was very helpful to me was a relatively newly found account by the cabin boy, Thomas Nickerson. And Nickerson, late in life, wrote his account. And he had talked to the other survivors, clearly had read Chase's account. He's an old man looking back, and in his account, which is in this wonderful composition book at the Nantucket Historical Association,
wow.
He claims they had enough bread to survive. He could not, late in life, admit to having been a cannibal, which, you know, that's the thing about narratives. They're all self-serving in some form. Mm. You know, Chase was an officer trying to put a bad voyage in the best possible light. Nickerson was an old man trying to put his sufferings in a way that, you know, he did not demean himself in the most unspeakable crime. And that's, you know, as a historian, you got to sift through that and try to come up with your best concept of what actually happened.
Nathaniel Philbrick, thanks so much.
It's been a pleasure.
Nathaniel Philbrick is the author of In the Heart of the Sea. The film adaptation of his book, starring Chris Hemsworth, is in theaters on Friday. And here's something to take with you today. How's that coffee taste? And when is a whale like a butterfly? If that whale hadn't busted up the Essex back in 1820, then Herman Melville might not have been inspired to write the novel Moby Dick. And so there would have been no first mate Quaker intellectual named Starbuck as a backup. When the name of Captain Ahab and Starbuck's ship, the Pequod, was rejected as a name for a certain startup coffee company in Seattle back in 1971. How do you like your coffee now that you know it came from an angry whale? How's that for a butterfly effect? A world without Starbuck would be Pequod. I'll take the Pequod Grand Peppermint Spice Latte. Doesn't quite work. We're happy about that whale, I suppose. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.